Thank you very much for pitching up early this morning. You can see they don't do social media, but they do selfies.
This is not for social media.
No, you're such a special crowd. It's such a wonderful setting, so I couldn't hesitate.
It's a pleasure to be up here with Jan and Emanuele. I think Emanuele described our little race team, which is based, as you can hear, I'm a South African, based out of South Africa, as the team of friends. And that's the spirit that they've joined us in this panel here today. As was mentioned earlier, they don't really need an introduction. It's 36 Le Mans appearances between them, 5 victories for Emanuele, 1 famously for Jan with Jaguar in 1988. Jan did 24 Le Mans. They've won numerous Daytonas, Sebring races. This morning, Emanuele said he's done something like 20 24-hour races around the world. So a wealth of experience on this panel. But much more than that, they have careers spanning since the 70s. So they've seen all these different phases of motor racing to the high-tech age of today. And they've not only witnessed them, but they've actually been participants in those various phases and in the engineering that goes with them. So we're going to focus our talk today on 4 areas. One is whether motorsport is a sport or a business. Is it all about technology, or does the driver still have a role? Is this a sport where we no longer have revolutions in technology, but it's much more evolutionary? And then finally, what does it take to succeed in the sport? And hopefully we'll have some questions at the end and some time for that. So on the first question, the budget cap of a Formula One team is now $135 million a year. In the 1980s, Lotus, and I know that Jan tested for Lotus in its pomp, estimated it cost $1 million a year to be at the front of the grid, or $4 million in today's money. So you've seen a huge expansion in the amount of money pouring into the sport and thus the technology involved. A Formula One team in the 1970s might have numbered between 20 and 30 people. Today, Ferrari has over 400 people in its engine department alone. To get on the grid in Formula One today, a driver will have needed to invest around about $10 million, or have someone invest around about $10 million US dollars into their career. Karting, which is the initial stepping stone, can cost around $100,000 a year, even in the junior ranks. So it's a very difficult sport to access without considerable outside backing or a very rich parent, none of which any of us have enjoyed. A question for you, Emanuele, is Formula One today a sport still, or is it a spectacle, or does it manage to be both?
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say I'm really honored and proud to be here. It's a wonderful venue, and I thank you all for being here and listen. We don't listen ourselves so well, which is actually good, because normally you have a big echo. So do you listen to us properly, even yeah. at the first?
You hear us? Okay.
Great. What was the question? No, seriously.
What is your name?
Seriously. It's a tricky and difficult question, and I think a sport has got to sustain itself somehow. So there is nothing wrong in saying that something is a sport and a business, or it's a sport and a show. Nowadays, since I hope you guys are a little bit familiar with Formula One, but you know, since Liberty Media took over from Bernie Ecclestone, who actually created Formula One as a monster in a good way, the way it is, and made it generate a lot of money. A lot of attention has been put in presenting the sport to the fans in a better way. You know, Bernie was thinking Formula One is an elite sport. We make a lot of money by selling the television rights. We don't care so much about the fans. And if you can't afford coming to a race, tough luck, you know. Liberty Media obviously took a much broader approach, but there's a lot of criticism saying they want to make it a show, is no longer a sport. So what is the definition of a show and a sport? I think a show cannot be seen as a negative thing, because when we go, we're here, this is a show. We go to the movie theater, is a show. We go to a football match, is a show. So for me, there is nothing wrong in trying to produce a better show if it's good for the fans. For me, what is really not correct is Formula One, like football, you know, it's producing a lot of money. Now the turnover only of Formula One is over $2 billion. I don't know whether it's US dollars, euro, it doesn't matter. No. It's not South African rands. Anyway. So
it's about $200 billion, yeah.
It really produces a lot of money, and in theory, all this money should support the whole of motorsport. But before this budget cap, which is basically a limitation imposed by the rulers to the teams not to spend more, teams were spending every penny they had, because literally every penny you spend more, somehow you buy a little bit more technology. And so it doesn't matter how much money you make, like in football. If you spend more than what you make, you are not in good shape. So this budget, and so many, many Formula One teams actually throughout history closed because of bankruptcy and, you know, because of not being able to afford themselves. And I think Jan witnessed this era of Formula One more than me. This budget cap, all of a sudden, put a halt on this big expenditure and made a Formula One team run properly, profitable. And now if you want to buy a Formula One team, first of all, nobody wants to sell it. Maybe some of you knows that Andretti, they tried to get into Formula One and they can't make it. And, you know, the value of a Formula One team as a business became really, really, really big. So I think this is something football also should do, because if you put a halt to a stop, you generate a lot of money, it just works. So it's a business, now it's a smart business somehow. I like it the way it is now, because drivers are fighting close to each other, and more than I like it, I hate people who don't like it, because now with social media, it's so easy to speak bad. Face. You know, those who want to criticize have got such a loud voice, or louder than those who want to. So there's a lot of negativeness, and I just don't like it. So I like it even more.
Every sport, of course, needs heroes and villains. That's a key part of the spectacle, so you do need to do it in that way. Jan, I want to turn to you.
Yeah.
As somebody whose youngest son is working his way up the ranks of from karting into Formula 4, do you still think, and I guess you're going to answer this question in a particular way, there's still place for natural talent in the sport, or is it all about rich, ambitious dads? And what can be, excluding yourself,
yeah.
And what can be done to promote the natural talent over the rich, ambitious fathers and create upward mobility, more upward mobility in the sport?
Well, I think natural talent is still something, you know, that has a chance. It's a privilege, first of all. Also, I think, you know, sitting here in this wonderful environment, to not mention the world environment, to hear all these amounts. Formula One is to many of us perceived and maybe in reality a very nouveau riche material sport. And if you hear all those millions and billions going around, then you wonder, like, can't we spend this money in a different way? Also, when you talk about you know, the value of the sport, and is it a sport or a business, I think it is very important to realize that in a way it is like an entertaining lab. It is a traveling circus all around the world, but in fact it is like a traveling laboratory. Just to give you an idea, and that probably also just gives you a little bit of background information about everything else we are going to talk in the next 45 minutes, 50 minutes, is that if you realize in my days in the shadow Formula One, I made my debut in 1979, and we left the pit lane with like 174, 175 liters of fuel. And not the unleaded fuel, no, it was the dirty fuel. That's it. Very dangerous cars. You never knew in the morning whether you would still be there in the afternoon. So also from a safety point of view, we have come a long way. In the Starting grid that I joined in those days, there were also the Renault turbo cars, the Ferrari turbo cars at a later stage. They would take more than 210 liters of that dirty fuel. We left with about 500 horsepower, and let's say, to come back to a normally aspirated engine, we had 500 horsepower, 175 liters of dirty fuel. At the moment, we have 1,000 horsepower, and they leave with about 137 liters of fuel, which is unleaded and which has 10% biomethanol. So just to give you an idea how far we have come, and the big money spent in Formula One is mostly spent by manufacturers or multinationals, people, companies like Microsoft and you name it, Oracle, and huge companies have come in and joined. But together, I think it is an entertainment to the pleasure of a lot of people. They enjoy it. But at the same time, we're also achieving something that the cars and the environment is benefiting from on the normal road. So I think that's important to just state that before we continue talking about all this. Is there still room for young talent? I think it's important to also realize that while we are fighting for every thousandth of a second on a racetrack, we have done so many Le Mans and 24-hour races together, but you know, in all fairness, how important is it? You drive 24 hours, you win the race, you park, but you're still at the same spot as where you started. So, you know, big deal. So have we stopped racing tomorrow? I don't know how the world's going to change. But if you know, from lots of other important issues in the Middle East and now in the war with Russia and Ukraine, if we see like what is really important in life, you know, is winning a race or fighting for that last thousands in sector one so important? Well, it is. Because they're young kids, they're athletes, sports should still unify and bring us all together. We have the European Championship football at the moment. Well, we see how we all come together. And it's a great thing. So I think there is a big social aspect to the sport, but also it is all about winning, and it's not. It is just like reaching your target and achieving goals. And just the fact that it's the way there that is so nice and inspiring. So for us, you know, with René, yes, it's all about winning, but that's our personal target. But for the rest, we want to make sure that we sort of perform and inspire. So make it useful for a larger good. So
I want to come back to that, but can I ask you, as a Dutchman, whether Max Verstappen's success has become a national phenomenon? Has it made your job much easier?
Oh yes,
converting people to motorsport.
Oh yeah, I earned four times more money. Four times nothing is still nothing. Yeah. No, no, absolutely. It's just it's sort of introduced Formula One. There's a new late adapters, you know, a new broad breed of people that adapted late since Max Verstappen. And he, like in the beginning year that he was successful, if he dropped out, then the TV audience collapsed. But that's not so anymore because they got to know Lando Norris and of course Lewis Hamilton and all these other great drivers. You know, Ricciardo is a great character. Leclerc. There's a lot of wonderful people and sportsmen out there. And Max introduced Formula One and introduced his fellow race drivers. So now if he drops out, they keep watching.
But inspiration is so important in life, not only in sport. I think one of the things, you know, I think we've been doing what we have been dreaming since kids. And one of the things I'm thankful for about my life is that when you do a high-level whatever, in our case, sport, you come across very, very capable people. And I think having an inspiration, having somebody you want to be like him one day, whether he's a racing driver, whether he's a team principal, whether he's a state president in his case, or whatever, it's a gift. And I think if you develop the attitude of trying to learn from people who are better than you, who know more than you, it's really, really important. And I'm sure Jan and I would be different people had we not been racing drivers for so many years, because you just come across incredibly talented people and you just get inspired.
I mean, there's something to be said about motorsport as being this great integrator of technology, theater. I mean, you mentioned Netflix, but that's become a very important part of the branding of motorsport. Engineering talent, logistics, absolutely crucial, as well as driving talent and physical ability. Now, your two sons, your and Marlene's two sons, Marlene's somewhere out there? And she went to a better talk. she's heard it all before. Are both in the motorsport engineering business. They both studied here, I think, in the UK.
Yeah, correct.
I guess a lot of people would ask, who has been more important to Red Bull's success? Has it been Adrian Newey, the recently departed chief technical officer, or Max Verstappen, before Max Verstappen, Sebastian Vettel? I mean, are both equally as important? And how do you differentiate the kind of design team from the driving talent in terms of their value or weighting in the Formula One team?
I'm so happy he didn't mention the word percentage, because if there is something I really, really hate, is what is the percentage driver and car?
Which I said weighting.
Because for me, it just makes no sense. There is no goal you can achieve without having everything state of the art. So one exercise you could do is, you have a Formula One field, you put the worst driver in the best car and vice versa, maybe you can work out something. But definitely, and this is something I feel a little bit sorry about, because our sport is so complicated, because it's a technology sport. So to really have a feeling, a perception of the quality of the work put into and the effort put into a given project, it's very, very difficult. Simpler sports like football, you can really see how Maradona was able to talk to the ball and the ball sticking to his foot. I mean, even if you
to
were not
hand,
an expert.
I think, to his hand, many.
Yeah. God.
The hand of God.
The hand of God.
Us of a certain age remember this.
And in motorsport, it's really difficult. But what I can say, Greg, is there are examples where a single man makes a big difference. Like, when Michael Schumacher joined Ferrari, as usual, was coming from a drought of, as often happened in history, of victories. Then he comes in, he's an exceptional racing driver. Of course, a few more key people were brought in, but slowly but surely, his talent, his motivation, his dedication, which again is difficult to perceive from outside, was contagious, and so it made become the whole team a better group of people. I think all of us, and probably this is one thing that you learn from sport, all of us have got far more potential than what we think we have. And in special occasions, when we are inspired, when we are in special circumstances, sometimes we even surprise ourselves how good we can perform, both physically and intellectually. And so, and sometimes to deliver special things, many stars have to align. So Adrian Newey, the designer of the car, fundamental. Max Verstappen, fundamental. Mechanics, everybody basically has been dragged up, and now it's almost an unbeatable operation. And this is why sometimes it's difficult to have, often you have a winner for a number of races or even years, because you get stronger and stronger, and it's difficult to beat them. So you need everybody doing 100%.
So it's no longer a sport in which a single person can make a difference.
No, it's funny because, you know, motorsport, one driver. In our case, when we did the long distance races like Le Mans, you have two or three drivers. But Formula One is one driver. So you might define it as a single sport, whilst football is a team sport. But really, it's so much of a team sport, our sport, and it's so important to really have a bond. I had the privilege to be development driver for McLaren in F1 in the time of Prost and Senna when they were winning on the races. So that was the quintessence of a winning team. And I was more junior than them in age, a little bit. And when I started to work with them, I realized not only they were better drivers, but you know, better a good driver is a combination of things. They were doing a number of things better than me that I could do, you know, dedication, motivation to the others, attention to details, questioning yourself, how could I have done something better? So it was an incredibly useful life lesson. And there I learned what a privilege you have to be together with superstars, with exceptional people.
And like being on the stage, yeah.
Like here on the stage, yes, yes. And having such an audience and so on and so forth.
So Jan, your son, René,
yeah,
is 15. He's, as I said, ascending the ranks of various formula. How do you help prepare him for his, not just driving challenges, not just the ability to talk to the technology and reflect that back? How do you prepare him for the life ahead as a professional racing driver?
Well, I think it's pretty much the same as you like to do with any of your kids. First of all, you'd like to raise them with the right values about life, what's right and wrong, and all those normal things. But also at the same time, it's like trying to get your kid in the right environment, the right school, the right class, etc. There's a certain amount of luck involved until they are, you know, at this age, 15, 16, that they sort of like get into the right environment and group of friends. So that has a lot of influence because at home you can do so much, but what happens in school, you've all seen that happen, can be of a bigger influence than what you can contribute. So to just expose them and bring them in the right environment is one of the important things. Then, you know, you grow up in this material world, and like Emanuela already said, like it's hard to quantify if you get into that business, you know, how much percentage and that. If anything, if you compare that sort of thing, like a soccer player, he needs a ball, and a racing driver needs a car. But obviously a car is much more complex than a ball. You can race and deflate it or inflate it or whatever. So to get the best from a car, and that car has been designed in this example by Adrian Newey. So it's his concept of how he thinks this car should be. But then he needs a driver to drive it in that certain way that he designed it for. And to have that match is a matter of fine-tuning. So if anything, if you have a 100% driver, you still have to get the car and the driver together to have the total of 200%. And nobody reaches that, but you can try to get as close as possible. For René, it is first of all, you have to be very aware of like when do you have to be the coach and when you have to be the father. I have tried to be, and I'm still trying to be the coach for as short a time as possible. I want to let him sort of float as much as possible.
It must be tough though, huh?
Well, in a way, it's easy. Well, also, it's an important thing is that the difference in age between Max Verstappen and his dad is 25 years, and the difference in age between René and me is 52 years. So whatever I may know or may be able to do or whatever, it's is it relevant? That's the big key question that you have. So I have a lot of answers to questions that he hasn't got. So I just have to make sure that I don't bombard him with all my things. So I really don't want to limit him to me. I want him to go much further, and I think he will go much further. But these days also, You might not be aware of that. We have a designer that designs the car. He interprets the playing field, i.e. the technical regulations. So this is his playing field. He designs this car. And then at the racetrack, you have an engineer. And an engineer just sort of analyzes the data. It's just infinite at the moment. And they analyze their quickest lap race or whatever. And then they see where they can improve the car. At the same time, these days, we have driver performance coaches. Those are coaches that look at the data and they tell the driver how they can just get closer to what the car wants. So on one hand, the technical team tries to bring it as much to the driving style of the driver, and the driver performance coach tries to bring those things together. So that's how you raise them. And, you know, to answer your question, where am I going to sit in between? You know, we all know this situation that we are messing around with our phone and something is not going quickly, and then either your child or grandchild just grabs the phone and solves it in 10 seconds. That's the world we live in. And 2026, Formula One goes to 50-50. 50% of the power they produce comes from a normal internal combustion engine, and the other 50% they have to generate electricity or generate their own power. So it's a totally new age, new technology. So for the future, I think future Formula One teams should have one experienced guy and one very young, 15, 16, 17, the younger the better, because they have those quick minds, can interpret things much quicker. And also the engineers, they won't be the age of Adrian Newey anymore. They will be 30.
I'm going to come back to you on 30. How driving has evolved and changed. Both That's these gentlemen did around 40 Grand Prix in Formula One. And subsequent to that, Emanuele has been very involved in the FIA in various capacities as a steward.
FIA is the International Federation.
Yeah. It could stand for something else, but I'll leave that to your imagination. in both circuit design as well as regulation, as well as being a steward at various Grand Prix. It seems that today a lot of advantage is gained in the wind tunnel and in the workshop. And yet, a lot of the applicability of these technologies, think of the very finicky aerodynamics, for example, or some of the electronics, and if you go back to the turbo era, the fuels that were used, for instance, which Jan referred to, don't seem to have very much application to everyday life. So I guess the two questions that follow is motorsport today a follower or a leader in everyday technology? Do these technologies have application, or should be more be done to improve that linkage between the two? And then, is the regulatory environment best suited to encourage revolutionary thinking, or is it more focused on improving the spectacle and regulating the way in which cars race with each other? In other words, to what extent does politics and drama trump innovation?
I'm not sure you asked the question to the right guy, but what I'm going to say, ladies and gentlemen...
I'll decide that. I'll decide that.
it's really my own opinion. But I am a very, straightforward, pragmatic, honest person. So the manufacturers throughout motorsport history have justified their presence in motorsport and their heavy investments with the fact that they learn from racing and they transfer this into car production. My personal opinion is that since the very, very beginning, every manufacturer who decided to do motor racing, they decided to do to sell cars, not to learn. Eventually, they learned, especially in the old days, a lot of innovations came from racing. This is a fact, because the research and development department of production was very small, and racing somehow was advanced, and technology available was very limited. But since a number of years, the R&D department of production cars have a lot bigger budgets than racing budgets. But still, it's good to tell the world this story. We spend a lot of money because we want to learn. I drove a large number of years. I think I've been altogether more than 20 years for Audi. And these are all the Le Mans 24 hours that I raced. And Audi, their motto is, be leader in technology, quattro, and so on and so forth. Audi wanted to promote the diesel technology for road cars. And so they decided to build a Le Mans car with the diesel engine. And we were the first to win Le Mans with the diesel engine, which was a very advanced project. And we were telling the story, we are racing a diesel engine to learn more because, in the older days, diesel engine was more seen for trucks and cheap cars and so on. And they wanted to use it. They wanted to show that diesel engines could be very powerful and could be used even in more sportive cars. But so the message was, we race to learn how to make faster and powerful engines for road vehicles. But this is not really true. So there's quite some demagogy in this, and for me, I think more and more racing and automotive are diverting. In racing, one of the most important thing is the driver has to drive alone and unaided. This is why there is no traction control. This is why there is no, thank God, there is no ABS. This is no stability control. And all this feature to help the driver to keep the car on the road. As much as possible, the rule makers, they try to make the driver being on top of the car, not following. From the other end, automotive is going towards autonomous driving, which as much as I love driving, I think this is the ultimate solution to avoid car accidents and fatalities on the road. When all cars one day hopefully will still be alive, will talk to each other and merge each other, there will be no more traffic. So more and more we have to accept that motorsport is going one way and automotive is going another way. And I think manufacturers should change their message and not feel ashamed to say, we do motorsport because we want to enhance our sporting image. We want to promote our brand. They are not ashamed of doing publicity in paper, in billboards, commercials on TV, which are purely emotional, nothing to do with technology. There is nothing wrong in that. Watches and fashion, they do that. But somehow manufacturers are still a little bit too much on the message, we want to learn.
Do the regulations help?
Regulations, as you said, I sit in different places on the federation, and one of the last thing I'm responsible for the single seater race cars, not Formula One, everything else for FIA. So the federation has to shape, let's say, the future of motorsport, and especially where manufacturers are involved, like sports cars, for instance. Now it's a golden time for sports cars. In this year, Le Mans, there were I think 6 or 7 large manufacturers fighting for the overall win. So the rule makers have been in the Endurance Commission for a number of years. The rule makers, they want to do something good for the motorsport. So they want to involve manufacturers, but somehow they want to keep the cost under control. My endurance days until 2010, there were no budget caps. So Audi, Porsche, Toyota were spending insane amount of money. Then the Dieselgate came, the world changed very quickly. So it's frightening to think about the money they spend, but this money were available. Now you need to design a sport that is attractive for manufacturers, because without manufacturers, the sport would not really be at this level, but affordable for manufacturers. It's a very, very difficult balance. This is why sometimes haters, when they criticize the rules, mm-hmm. come with a proposal before saying that I'm not saying that what the federation does is all good, not at all. But it's not easy to make everybody happy. Mm. In Italy we say, you want your jar of wine full, but your wife being drunk. So if you want your wife being drunk, you have to use the wine. You can't have everything.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe in Latin that makes more sense.
Okay. But I think you guys understood what I mean.
He was the right guy to ask the question to. Jan, to quote Adrian Newey again, because his cars have won more than astonishing 200 GP victories, he said, motor racing teaches a lot of good life skills. It teaches you that if you want to achieve something, you have to work hard at it. Driving a race car, he says, isn't just about strutting about in overalls. It involves mental and physical preparation, training, working with engineers, learning how to present and market yourself, and how to deal with failure and move on. Firstly, do you agree? And secondly, yeah. What sort of life skills did motorsport teach you?
Well, I agree fully. And secondly, I think it's so interesting because if you look at normal life, if we want to do anything, whatever it is, work-wise, personal-wise, whatever trip you want to do, you work out like, okay, what is it that I want to do? And then you see how much money it costs. Do you have the money? Is it feasible within the time frame? Whatever. And whether that is building a house, making a trip, it doesn't matter. And then you come to the conclusion like, well, you know, that's impossible. So you just add up and subtract, and then you decide like, yeah, this is impossible, so we won't do it. In motor racing and in sports, many times, and particularly if you have a lot of ambition, and also in creativity, talking from a designer's perspective of Adrian Newey, you have something, and then you think like, well, this is impossible, so let's do it. You know, with our son, René, we want to get into Formula One. If you really make a mathematical choice or calculation like, you know, what are the chances, then you come to the conclusion it's practically impossible. Great, so let's do it.
Like because Igor Sikorsky with the
helicopter.
With the helicopter and the Beetle.
Exactly, let's do it.
Technically, and he cannot fly, but he doesn't know.
Exactly. Who are we to decide? You know, I don't show up in church every Sunday, but I'm a very religious person, and I think it's not up for us to decide whether something is possible or not. And so to doubt yourself is one thing, you know, but to doubt yourself in a God-given perspective, who are we to decide what is not possible? And so just the fact that you cannot see the total course and the result in the beginning doesn't mean it's impossible. No, you start on something and following the lines of when the time is there, so will be the answers. That is what blind faith is called about, you know, all about. So although you don't know exactly all the steps, but you start with the total faith that when the time is there, so will be the answers. And it's like climbing a mountain. With every step you take, your view changes, your knowledge changes. So, you know, you will find a way. It's a beautiful movie. I forgot what it's called. Maybe you know it. But if you build it, they will come. You know, what is the title of the movie? Maybe somebody remembers. Field of Dreams. That's it, yeah. So if you build it, they will come. And I think life is a little bit like that. So creativity is also something that it's not somewhere in the stores where you can pick it off the shelf. No, it's not there yet. You have to think of it and then design it, and then it's there. So it's not a reality yet. So this whole thing of possible or impossible and design and everything.
How did you deal with success and failure?
Well, success, I always feel, is like half the value, you know. We know here in the Premier League football, you know, all those successful players, when they stop with all their millions, you know, I think 50% within 5 years go bankrupt. So success is half the value. So success is something you have to manage. If you don't manage your success, it will still turn into failure. If you reach the top of the mountain and you forget that you also have to go back, yeah, you will die halfway on your return. So I think you have to manage your success. And also, like this example with René, our son, it's not that I want to try and have his focus on like becoming a world champion Formula One. I prefer to let them think like, when you achieve your goal and when you are world champion Formula One, what are you going to do? So it's not an end. It's like an achievement within a larger perspective that you've created. And failure, I think that if you, you know, you have to see failure as an opportunity to grow. Because failure is like the greatest teacher you can have. So accept it. And you know, I love my own failures as much as my successes. If you look at any, from a business point of view, if you look at like the balance sheet, there is a positive and a negative, and they both have to be there. In the end, you have to see like, okay, what is the ultimate result? Is that positive? Wonderful. But you have your positive and your negatives, otherwise there's no process.
In moments that I feel very angry with my job, which is often, and I despair, my wife always reminds me of a very important, I think, lesson, which is, don't get angry, get organized, get you know, actually work out what you want to do.
But if it's your wife telling you, you get even more angry. The problem is this. The top is wise, but the source should be different.
We'll get Marlene to answer that in a moment. But I do think it's important. How did you manage success and failure too, Emanuela? Did you start the sport with the same goals that you emerged from your professional career with?
No. By all means, no. I had... a lot, you know, I'm from 1962. I started racing karts in 1973. For your information, I came across this gentleman because, and then he reminded me we did two karting world championships. One in Le Mans. Le Mans in 1970. Le Mans was 78.
I was 6 years old.
And, you know, when you do an event like this, there are maybe 60 drivers, so you don't really remember all the drivers, but we actually raced against each other. You obviously had a significant weight handicap. This is why.
Already then? Already then.
But
he's charming, normally.
Now, failure, I have my personal view on that. For me, it's not a matter of being first in a race. I set my own goals, and sometimes my own goals are not really in line with the ranking in the race. So often I've been very happy with what I achieved, even if I was not first in a given circumstance. But as a person, I'm a positive person. I'm somebody who always looks ahead and so on and so forth. So I hate to use the word regret. It doesn't belong to my vocabulary. But unfortunately, the only events in my career that I recall often, and they come often in my mind, are the failures. Of course, we had plenty of failures, but I mean those where I could really and I should have done much better. There's a number of those that still come back in my mind. I have done it, so... It's history, but sadly, they still come up very, very much, and I don't know how to deal with them. The things that go well, I think this is the way it should be, so somehow, of course, I remember with joy, but they just don't come back in my mind. So in my next life, I have to tune up this because it doesn't help me so much.
We have 15 minutes left, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed being up here. Raise your hands if you'd like to ask a question. There's a gentleman at the back there with the glasses on, over there.
Yeah, also. Sorry.
And then we'll come down the front. There's two in the front here. There are two microphones. You can bring them a second mic down the front.
Why, you are a director.
I'm a director, yeah.
Gentlemen, you've spoken about... the disciplines, the very specific focuses required to win races. There's this thing called being in the zone that you come across, that magical moment in certain particular races you may have undertaken where something very special happens, something really comes together? Ayrton Senna used to talk about it probably more than most. Can you tell us if and when that's happened to you and what you think that's about?
I'll let both have a go at that. Emanuele first.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's a complex question. For your information, Ayrton Senna once, he was very good in Monaco, and in a special circumstances, he was very religious, and he was saying, I was talking to God when I was driving, and he was driving really to the excellence. This was not arrogant. This was really, I think he really meant it. And I personally had it sometimes, not feeling that you talk to, I am religious, but for me, God is busy with other things. But you know, you get, hopefully, no, it, I mean, I don't want to offend him, I'm really religious. But you get into a dimension where almost you get carried away by what you do. You feel really one piece with the car. It's really hard to describe, but it's sort of esoteric and special. It doesn't happen often, but when you have the privilege to feel this, you feel you are unbeatable. You feel that you can do nothing more than what you are doing. You feel, which is not true, because there is always somebody who can do it better. But it's a very special feeling that, without any drugs and alcohol, sometimes you can have the privilege to feel it, and it's really, really special. You don't dare to share it with the people, not even with the engineers, because it's not very scientific, or you know. But it's special. I don't know if you have.
Is that and I'll just start redirection to Jan. Is that something that happens every now and again, or but if you watch someone like at his peak, Zinedine Zidane, he always looked like he had so much more time on the ball than all the other players. It was everything slowed down around him. Is that the same feeling when you're in the zone?
Well, the zone is something that you always strive for, but it's hard to achieve. You know, it's like laying awake at night and you want to sleep. Just the very fact that you want it keeps you awake. And I think many of us see ourselves following the contours of our body, you know, like where our skin stops is where the rest of the world begins, and you know, and that's the separation. I always take it as an example. If you take a drop from the ocean and you give it a name, then there is the intimidating big ocean and the tiny drop. And that's a little bit how some of us feel. You feel like that tiny drop compared to that big ocean, which is a lot of nonsense, because the drop is as much the ocean as the ocean is the drop. So it is this kind of individual sense existing in this larger body, where we are part of something that is much larger than we are. We are the result of something much larger. And if you can all of a sudden, following the lines of, let's say, let go and let God, that you can just feel like an aspirin dissolves in the water, that you can just completely let go. And at this moment, if I try to achieve that, I am feeling completely one with you. And then you feel a sense of relaxation in yourself. And then you're very sensitive to everything around you, and in our sense, the race car. Then you feel completely at one. When you leave a parking spot, sometimes you miss it by a millimeter, because you can extend your feeling of the size of the car. And it's this oneness with the car that we all try to achieve, and we try to meditate, to visualize, to relax, all in an objective to get that tensed sense of us and the rest of the world away, and to be one with.
So you must have done, I was trying to work it out here, 24 Le Mans, let's say, 300 laps per car, roughly, 100 laps per driver. So 3,000 laps, more or less, at Le Mans. Is there one lap that stands out, that was the one that all came together?
Not really, not particular. I think during Le Mans, you're part of a larger team, like Emmanuel already said, and You know, Le Mans, sometimes we make the failure, and I'm sure that Emanuele agrees, we make the failure of saying, I won Le Mans. I won nothing. You know, I was one of the people, part of that team who won it. What you can do on your own is lose it, you know, if you crash the car. Mm. You know, and this is very illustrative to life, you know, in a destructive way, in a negative way, you can achieve something alone. You forget to switch an alarm on, you whatever, you know, you can just set a whole refinery on fire, whatever. So individually, we've seen plenty of accidents in the world you can create. But if you want to do something positively, you need each other. So it's just enormous teamwork. And so, I can't sort of pick out one lap where I say that was it. It was just like a whole, flow. Sometimes one of these things where on Monday or Tuesday you think, what have I done? You know, was that us? You know, and then you feel very privileged and very satisfied, of course.
Question down here.
And just before I ask the question, I'd just like to say I had the good fortune to meet Diego Maradona once, and the chap I was with wouldn't shake his hand and called him a bloody basketball player to his face. So that didn't go down very well. I don't think he understood English that well, which is just like. But the question I wanted to ask the chaps was that I read Martin Brundle's book some years ago, Working the Wheel, which is an excellent book, and each chapter he talks about his experiences of driving different tracks. And if memory serves, Le Mans came out as the pinnacle for him of a circuit to drive. I'd just like to ask you both what it's like to drive at Le Mans.
Manuela?
No, Le Mans, it is a beautiful racetrack because it's long, because it's challenging, and because it's like floating, you know, there are no heavy braking. Actually, I shouldn't say that because I am, since a number of years, in the circuit commission of FIA. But the modern, the artificial modern circuits, they are sort of designed in a way which is meant to become, to make it difficult. But somehow the really good and challenging circuits are those who reflect the environment and the roads which are in the area. Le Mans initially was part of traffic roads. But what makes it challenging is the high speeds, the high-speed corner and the high speeds on the straight. This is really, unfortunately or fortunately, the more challenging, the more risky, the more difficult something is, the more reward you get. Stirling Moss, once he said, he was asked, what is the difference between being a racing driver now and a racing driver in his days? And he said, the difficulties are probably similar, but the risks and the reward are different. It's like walking on a rope. You know, you need the same skill, but today there's a mattress behind, and in our days we are walking across the Grand Canyon. So it's probably this sense of reward feeling that gives you.
Did you do the old straight also? The very long?
Yes, I've done it. Yeah. Which wasn't funny because the old straight was 6 kilometers flat out, and there is no skill whatsoever required. But you know, there's always the risk of something breaking in the car. So sometimes you feel I need to relax. Yeah. Sometimes you think about things.
I mustn't relax.
Yeah.
Well, the top speeds we reached there in those days. I mean, with the Jags, we reached 250 miles, 251, depending a little bit on where the wind went. But it's still part of the normal road, so it's very exceptional. And I think the biggest change there, fantastically, is the Porsche corners. I mean, you can do 24 hours, and then the very last lap of the race, you still come up to the Porsche corners, and you sort of like shrug your shoulders, you go, here we go, you know? And it's phenomenal. It's really, really...
Sometimes it's so difficult to describe, at least for us, but sometimes when I do something and there's a lot of people and I drive a beautiful car in a nice way, I really feel I would like to take everybody on board to make this, to feel this joy of the forces, the precision that you... It's hard to describe, but it's pretty cool.
It's another version of the answer to the question up there. Last question in the front here. The gentleman behind you, sorry.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I thought it was really interesting to listen to you, very reflective in more ways than one. My question is, in your respective long motoring careers, can you both tell me, or all three of you, if necessary, tell me the moments in your motoring careers where you were happiest in the motoring perspective?
Jan.
Yeah, it's not hard to answer, because that's not one thing. And what surprised me mostly, and that's what I try to tell young drivers, is like just embrace the moment. Because if you think back of your career, it seldom is somewhere on the podium where you think that was my nicest moment. It could be the train ride back from Suzuka to Tokyo, or God knows what. So it's very weird but special moments that stick in your memory. From a racing point of view, I would have to say probably my qualifying lap in Formula One in Long Beach 1980. You have to bear in mind that I was struggling to qualify. There was in those days sometimes more than 30 cars trying to qualify for 20 places in Monaco and 24 on a regular grid. I didn't qualify in South Africa. I come to Long Beach and I cross the start-finish line and I see P1 on my board. So for 50 minutes I hit P1. I immediately went on the escape road because I sat on the straight. I thought, P1? And oh shit, I forgot the braking, so excuse my French. But so I think that's probably my most wonderful moment. But being here at this moment and looking at all of you, I think I would have to pick the 24 hours of Le Mans with I think 300,000 Brits there singing the national anthem. We could walk over the people. That was fantastic. So those two moments, sorry to take up so much.
Emanuele.
Hard to say, but probably my first go-kart a national championship win, for some reasons, because we were struggling a little bit, with the budgets and stuff, and the first year that we competed in the championship in the last race, and it was an eventful championship that I'm not going to bother you, but anyway, at the end when it happened, and when you are a child, you also you are more. Your spirit is more free, so you are less wise, and you tend to. But I felt I am the champion of Italy, which is not. I mean, it was true, but I'm the best today. I'm the best driver of my own country. It was a very special feeling. I even feel ashamed to share it with you because I'm not arrogant at all. But that was a great feeling.
Nice.
That was a great feeling.
Nice.
It's been a fantastic.
I was reminded many times that. That it was not the case that I was the best.
It's been a great panel.
But there was a gentleman who, you pointed to him, and then the microphone was given to the other one. So it's not fair. I think you should.
Okay, that who is it?
Yeah, him, okay, he should be given the chance.
A quick question, because we have 1:27 left.
Six.
Otherwise,
five.
We are fired, or
yeah, because that gun is going to go off, and we're both all going to have a heart attack.
Okay.
Very quickly, is there a fundamental difference between a top F1 driver and a long-distance driver? Very quickly. For example, Tom Christensen, I think his name is, great Le Mans driver, but wasn't in Formula One that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Emanuele?
Yeah, very quickly, the very, very, very best drivers are in Formula One, but some drivers like Tom, he never competed in Formula One. He would have been a very good Formula One driver. However, no bullshit, the best Formula One drivers are in Formula One, and you look at the salary, there is no charity there. So the one who are paid a lot of money, so we won endurance races, but for me, Formula One drivers are the best. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of very, very good drivers. Tom was one of them. He would have been excellent, very, very good. But the question is always, will you be like a Gasly, Ricciardo, Perez, or whatever? Or are you one with the X factor, like Hamilton, Verstappen, and you name it? So Senna, of course. So I think Tom definitely would have been one of these great drivers, whether he had the X factor, he had to show us ourselves, and he unfortunately didn't get that opportunity.
So a few years ago, Jan and myself were doing the 24 hours of Paul Ricard in France. And we were sitting on the grass watching the last few laps flash by. And I said to Jan, wouldn't it be fantastic to do this at Le Mans? And he said, no, this is as good as it gets. Yeah. We finished in third place,
yeah,
and we were, to use Emanuela's words from a few years later, in a team of friends. We didn't expect anything from each other. We were there, just there to have a wonderfully good time. And I think this morning's panel has been a wonderfully good time for two reasons. One is, it's said that you get two sorts of great sports people: those who have no brain, and you then don't have to think about what they're doing, it's completely just instinctive. And then there are those that have great intellect and who really think these processes through. I think we know with whom we were in the company of this morning. And the second is this remarkable humility. Not just thoughtfulness, but this humility whereby, there we go, on cue.
Fortunately, their aiming is not so good.
Yeah. The humility that you've heard expressed this morning. So please join me in thanking them in the traditional way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.